Welcome to The Wrap-Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sharon Waxman, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Joining me is my new co-host, Lawrence Yee, our assistant managing editor. And welcome to you, Lawrence.
Thanks, Sharon. I'm glad to be on the podcast.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to be exploring this new territory with you. We have done Clubhouse together, but I think this will be a fun new thing.
Absolutely.
So we got a packed show this week. This week I caught up with the Guilty star, Jake Gyllenhaal, and his director, Antoine Fuqua, both, I have to say, two of my industry favorites. And we talked about the film, but also about toxic male rage, which lies at the heart of it. And I also sat down with the Israeli filmmaker Gidi Dar to discuss Legend of Destruction. That's his new film that Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett was using to encourage his fractured parliament to watch and learn the lessons of civil wars in Israel's past.
Yeah, those sound like really great interviews. But first, let's get to the big headlines of the week. Obviously, last Sunday was the 2021 Primetime Emmy Awards. Yep. The Crown and Ted Lasso walked away as the night's big winners, but the biggest losers were actors of color. Of the 12 major acting prizes, all of them went to white winners, despite having a record number of nominees of color this year. Sharon, is hashtag #EmmySoWhite a wake-up call for the industry? These numbers are just, you know, discouraging.
Well, I think it's more complicated than just Emmy's So White, because when you have about a third of the nominations going to nominees of color, which was the case this year, and then none of them win, I mean, it sort of begs the question, what do you think the Emmy Academy, the TV Academy, ought to do? Should they require that some number of winners be winners of color? I think, you know, there were significant, I'd say, creative people who were across the board, both nominated and won. For example, Michaela Cole won in the writing category. You know, there were winners of color this year, but not in the acting categories. So, you know, which is tough in a year when you have a series like The Crown, which is literally an all white, like no diverse, you know, no Asians, no Black people, like at all. And then Ted Lasso, of course, which is another, you know, very predominantly white cast. So I think that really made it tough, because those were by far the most popular shows that were just sweeping. Right. So I don't know what the solution is, but I'm open to your thoughts.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think, you know, when you have a historical series about the British royal family, you're not going to have people of color. Unfortunately, that's just the reality. Although I think I read today they did cast Dodi Al-Fayed, you know, for their final season. Well, I think it's all about making
an actor to play.
Right.
Yeah, because Dodi's dead.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think, you know, I think one of the things is, you know, everybody thinks of it as getting a slice of the pie, but I think about it as making the pie bigger. You know, we have these prestige, you know, series like The Crown. Obviously, it's going to get nominated because they have wonderful actors, tremendous budgets and production values. But I think if I were a Netflix, you know, think about creating other prestige series with actors of color, looking at historical figures that might be Black or Asian or Latino or Indigenous, you know, or even creating a world like they did with Bridgerton. You know, reggae, you know, Jean was
Reggae John Page,
you know, as lead actor. But it's just about making more opportunities. I think, you know, Viola Davis put it, you know, so eloquently a couple of years ago, that the only thing that's preventing, you know, a Black actress is from being nominated and winning is opportunity. So I think it really is all about creating more opportunities. And if there is a runaway series, prestige series that is very much a front runner, that's fine. That's okay. And it should be celebrated. But let's make sure that there are many prestige series that are equally invested in with actors and creators of color. I think the challenge of seeing, you know, all of the acting winners win is that, you know, frankly, to the general audience, that is the most visible role, you know, because you see them on your screens. You don't necessarily see a writer, a director, you know, on the screen. It really is the most visible
role. I want to push back on one or two things that you're saying, because I think there were at least a couple of prestige series that were focused on the Black American or the Black experience.
Yeah.
Notably Underground Railroad by Barry Jenkins, which got shut out. And also Michaela Cole's I May Destroy You, which won her for writing, but not for any of, there was some really incredible performances, I must say, on that show.
Yeah.
But it really felt to me to be not a surprise that those shows did not win. For one thing, you know, The Crown is very, it's diverting. Ted Lasso is diverting. And right. You have to think about also, you know, Underground Railroad is a hard watch.
Yeah.
It's a really hard watch. And I think Barry Jenkins knows that because he wanted to take you to a place that where you were uncomfortable watching the experience of slaves on the Underground Railroad, even though he introduced these sort of magical realism and fantasy elements to it. But the idea that that's going to be like a crowd pleaser, right. You know, even though it's prestigious, is probably not so realistic. So maybe what we're saying is there's some kind of balance there, which is we don't just want the sort of experiences of suffering, which I've heard, you know, Issa right. Reyes talks about that quite a lot, of like, and they talk about, you know, experiences of Black joy, and obviously there's other ethnicities, not just the Black experience, but there's a lot to delve and unpack and to process over centuries from the legacy of slavery and racism that we have in this country. So it's not unusual that that would be the prestige series that comes up. So I think it's a process, and I think that we can't just necessarily isolate this year, because I do think the industry is making an effort, but yeah. I do take your point.
Yeah. And I think, you know, to your point, we look at another show like Lovecraft Country.
Lovecraft Country.
Heavily mm-hmm. nominated as well, but it is along the same lines. It is very kind of serious, dark in tone. You know, I agree with you that, you know, sometimes the Academy wants to look at something that is a little bit less. Certainly The Crown, I wouldn't call it a light show, you know, but I think it is a diversion.
What's the word for it? Yeah, it's like it transports you into, like, you know, you're living somebody else's. Right. You know.
And people know it. They know the story of Diana. They know the right. story of Prince Charles and Queen Elizabeth. So there is that reference point. And so, you know, it is something that has always captured the public imagination, the British royal family. So
yeah.
it means, you know, it's not a stretch. I think we're in agreement here. I want to use the example of Bridgerton because it is a fellow Netflix show, and mm-hmm. how they were able to create a world that is Black and white. I would just like to see more of that, you know, and ideally also grounding in hopefully some historical figures that can be celebrated, like an Aretha Franklin that we saw with Cynthia Erivo,
right,
and
true.
Whoever else may be there.
True. And, yeah. you know, there's tough competition. It's also true that the competition's pretty tough because there's so much television and there's really quite a lot of very good television. But anyway,
yeah.
So speaking of diversity, as we just have been around the Emmys, that is also a topic that came up when I sat down to record a conversation with the new executive editor of the LA Times, Kevin Merida, and Casey Wasserman of the talent agency Wasserman. This was essentially our kickoff conversation to our annual business conference, which is called The Grill, and that's going to be live streaming next Wednesday and Thursday. Registration is still open. Kevin, who himself is African-American and is a former colleague of mine from the Washington Post and all around, have to say, really talented editor and good guy, was talking about how bringing more diversity into the LA Times is a priority for him. And, you know, me, white lady, talking to somebody who is diverse, like, you know, I just was putting it out there for him to address. And he said, look, it's just like part of who I am, obviously. And, you know, his answer was, because there has been, as The Wrap has actually reported on this, unhappiness within the newsroom at the LA Times, particularly from the Latino contingent of reporters, but also from among Black reporters who have reported up to the owner, Patrick Soon-Shiong, that they felt that their ideas have been dismissed, that they have been passed over historically for promotions, and that they just overall don't have not felt that they've had a seat at the table of leadership and decision making. And so it was very interesting to have that conversation with Kevin about how he's prioritizing that and how, you know, his entire affect was, yeah, that's going to change. Like, it's just going to change.
I mean, it has to change. It has to change. Yeah.
So that was pretty interesting. I'm sure, you know, that was a major, you know, not a major, but a significant part of the mandate that in accepting the position that he says, look, this has got to be part of why I'm here. And of course, I imagine that that's one of the reasons why they wanted him there, because he brings so much credibility with him.
Casey talked about his grandmother requiring him to read one section of the LA Times every day and report back to her about it, which was pretty great. Here's a clip of that.
I mean, I grew up in L.A. I grew up every day reading. My grandmother said, I don't care what section. So, surprise, I picked the sports section. But I don't care what section you read. You have to read one section of the L.A. Times every day and tell me about it.
Really?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And, okay, 99.9% of the time it was sports section. But, you know, from Jim Murray and Alan Malamud and T.J. Simers and Plaschke and just this incredible history of writers. I mean, I don't think there's a... You can correct me. I'm not sure that there's a sports section in the country that has more Pulitzers than the LA Times.
Casey, of course, being the grandson of the legendary Lou Wasserman, and Lou and Edie Wasserman, I should say, who Lou being one of the great moguls and very significant executives in Hollywood history, and Edie Wasserman as a great philanthropist and civic leader in Los Angeles. I think Casey's really taken on the mantle of that very seriously. So it was cool. And we also will have lots of just a chock full speakers, including Scott Stuber, the head of global film at Netflix, including Phil Spencer, the head of Xbox, talking about gaming with Strauss Zelnick, who puts out Grand Theft Auto for, you know, years and years at Take-Two. We have, you know, several conversations around diversity and inclusion. How is the industry doing? How are we doing? On that topic, as change continues to be something that is a constant in this industry. So it's next Wednesday and Thursday. You can check it out if you just go to the Wrap Pro, Wrap Pro on therap.com, easy to find. You can register for just the price of your pro membership.
Yeah, so there you go. Lots of great panels that are coming up with a lot of kind of lively discussions, and I'm looking forward to it as well. Finally this week, the adaptation of the Broadway hit Dear Evan Hansen opens in theaters. Not only is it facing a strong competitor in Shang-Chi, which has dominated the box office for the last 4 weeks, but Dear Evan Hansen has been mired by negative early reviews and criticism for using teen suicide as a plot. But a lot of the online reaction, Sharon, has been of the casting of a 27-year-old Ben Platt as a 17-year-old teen. You know, there's a lot of comments about how he looks. It just feels strange. People are genuinely weirded out by his physical appearance. Do you think it's fair to judge a movie by how a lead actor looks?
Well, I've seen the movie. I have not seen the play. We should say that Ben Platt created that character, right? Like on Broadway. So it's not like they went looking for an older guy. Like, he's the guy who really is so connected to the character, won the Tony for that performance.
Right.
And it definitely didn't bother me as much as it's bothering the people who've gone viral, their hostility toward the movie online. And I think I feel kind of bad for Ben Platt, because he's been asked about it a couple of times. And then he said, like, I can't do anything about it. I'm trying to tune it out, but don't ever ask me to play Evan Hansen again. Like, I'm kind of done with it. The truth is, lots and lots of people in their 20s have played teenagers over the decades. I won't remind you of what John Travolta looked like in Grease, but you can go back and Google it and you can see he does not look like he's 17. But there was something that definitely has been rubbing people the wrong way about the film, for sure. And it's like the criticism is all over the map. Some of it is what you're talking about with how Ben Platt looks. They're going to say weird. I'm not going to validate that, but that is sort of what some of the people are saying online. They don't like that he breaks into song. It is a musical. They notably are criticizing both some of the early reviews out of the Toronto Film Festival last week, and in sort of the what people have been picking up online, that they think that it's exploiting the topic of teen suicide instead of exposing it to sort of understanding and empathetic, you know, treatment. And I think that is really hurtful to the folks at Universal who are releasing it to the producers. But I have to say that the film does not look like it's going to do very well. So
yeah,
right now it's tracking at about $9 to $11 million for opening weekend. That's not good. As you pointed out, Shang-Chi, I mean, can you imagine if it, in its third weekend or fourth weekend, it beats Dear Evan Hansen? That would be painful. But
yeah, you know, it's, I too have not seen the Broadway production. I think Ben is a tremendous talent. I think he's a wonderful singer. I think, as an actor, I was looking forward to seeing his acting in this movie. I have not screened this movie yet, but I have seen that feedback that there's just, again, a disconnect. Film is a visual medium. We look at characters, their expressions, first, and, listen second. And, when you see someone who doesn't kind of, it's that uncanny valley, right? I mean, he's only 10 years older than the character that he's playing. Certainly there have been, you mentioned 20-year-olds that have played teens. There's been 30-year-olds that have, played teens.
Yeah.
And, it's sometimes that your brain just doesn't register. And I don't think they're, like you said, I don't want to verbalize it because I haven't seen it yet, but I do understand why that phenomenon might happen to some people, where it's just like, there's just something off. And then you just can't shake it, no matter how invested you are with the plot, with the music, with the direction, whatever it may be, there's just something off. And, I guess it's going to be up to each individual and each film goer. So
the question is, though, does it poison, the well in terms of people going in with their sort of expectations set a certain way? We gave the film a pretty good review.
Yeah.
I know the LA Times gave it a pretty good review. And the studio's insisting that, it's kind of review proof. It's for teenagers. They don't read reviews. They may not read reviews, but they do go online on social media. The word of mouth can be really, really critical. And social media is this really tough thing for studios releasing movies to deal with because it moves so fast. So whereas it used to be, you'd have word of mouth would trickle through the weekend. Nowadays, as soon as people go to see the movie on a Friday in theaters, it's, that reaction is out within an hour or two and starting, often get velocity online that you can't shake.
Yeah.
So it's, it ain't for the faint of heart releasing movies, that's for sure.
Yeah, we'll have to see how it goes. And you're right. I think the other thing that, as you mentioned, that kind of makes everything a little bit more hastened is this is a film aimed at teens. It is about a high schooler. And we know those people on TikTok, they're very quick with their reactions and very harsh with their reactions as well. Or maybe just critical, So we'll see if there's some good kind of news that comes out of it, or some critical news and go from there. We do a segment on the podcast called Wax On, Wax Off. It's an opportunity for you, Sharon, to kind of wax poetic, as it were, pardon the pun, on some other kind of thoughts of the week. What are you thinking of this week? What's kind of captured your thoughts?
Well, I don't have a real wax on this week, except it's as the flip side of my wax off, which is hat tip, wax on to the team at the Wall Street Journal who've done this 5-part investigative series on Facebook that has been really penetrating, really excellent reporting, and has exposed a lot of information that has been buried inside of Facebook. Basically, the series has taken research that Facebook itself did about itself and revealed that Facebook has known about a lot of the damaging effects that the social media platform has had on different segments of society, whether that is Instagram, one of its huge properties, right, and how that has fed depression and anxiety among young teenage women who go on there and report that it shapes their sense of self, their sense of confidence because of these perfect images of people that they see on Instagram,
right,
and that they buried this. And when Mark Zuckerberg has been asked about this, he sort of goes like this in front of Congress, or says, I'm not really aware of any research. Well, in fact, they are. They had like slides of the decks or when it comes to vaccine misinformation. Another example where Facebook has been aware, more aware than it's been willing to talk about, or in the area of sex trafficking. I mean, these are very, very significant topics. So my hat tip is really to the Wall Street Journal. My wax on is the Wall Street Journal, and my wax off, of course, is to Facebook, right, which this is not the first time that I've brought this up, but this is, I feel like this really needs to be a watershed moment for us to finally have our government take action. I have been advocating for regulation, even though I am a free speech hardliner. I am a First Amendment absolutist in many areas, not to the point of crazy, but to the point of absolutely want to protect the individual's right to express themselves. But at the same time, we are now way past that with Facebook. They are not an honest broker when it comes to dealing with the criticisms that are leveled at them. And in fact, just this week, the New York Times followed up the Wall Street Journal series with its own independent reporting, talking about how Facebook is now using its news feed to promote positive pro-Facebook stories, and Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO, has signed off on us now having being fed PR through what's supposed to be their newsfeed. And I really wonder how people like Campbell Brown, who are bona fide journalists who are in charge of the news operation, or Ann Kornbluth, another former colleague of mine from the Washington Post, who now works at Facebook and curates that newsfeed, how they feel about the fact that that feed is being amplified with pro-Facebook stories without being marked advertisement or promotional.
Right.
So I think it is time. This is why we have a government, and this is why we have seatbelts now, and we have drunk driving laws, and we have, you know, helmets when you are supposed to be on your bike or on your motorcycle. It's to protect our society and our democracy. And I would say, please, government, see what is very clear in the reporting and in the evidence now, and let's do something about putting some guardrails on Facebook. That's it.
Well, that does it for this week's Wax On, Wax Off. When we come back, a fantastic interview with The Guilty's Anton Fuqua and star Jake Gyllenhaal.
Hi there, it's Sharon Waxman, the editor-in-chief of The Wrap, and I'm delighted to welcome to our Toronto Film Festival studio the director, Antoine Fuqua, and the star, Jake Gyllenhaal, of a film in the festival called The Guilty. Welcome, you guys.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
I think I didn't say that as elegantly as I should have somehow, but honestly, I'm just so thrilled to have you guys here. Antoine, I haven't seen you in a while. We talked a year ago at our grill conference about COVID. Jake, it's been years probably since we had a really long talk, I think when The Nightcrawler came out, and the world has turned upside down in that time.
Yes.
And the film is this really beautiful, taut study of Jake's character, who is a police officer. But Antoine, why don't I let you sort of lay it out for us quickly, what the film's about.
Well, I mean, Joe Baylor is a police officer who is put on 911 call duty against what he wants. He's a street cop, and he gets a phone call that comes in that changes his life, the course of the rest of his life. That's the storyline. But he is, for me, is Dante's Inferno. He's in purgatory. And the thriller takes you on this ride, and it twists and turns, and then you kind of, you know, reveals itself.
Are you saying he's in purgatory because he himself is waiting to be tried for some bad stuff that he did as a cop earlier, or he's in purgatory because the story's constantly keeping you on your toes, you don't really know what's happening?
Both. Yeah. He's dealing with his own internal demons. It's really more about his own internal demons is what he's dealing with. Right. The movie's called The Guilty. So he's dealing with something.
Yeah. You sort of, you frame it for when you come to the movie, you already know somebody's guilty. I think the brilliance of the movie is that it all takes place, for those who haven't seen it yet, and you're going to get to see it on Netflix shortly, is that it's all Jake, Joe, your character, talking, basically just it's you, all the action's happening through you on the phone, through various cell phone or the 911 calls you're taking and people's voices. And by the way, the other actors are so good just amazing. With their voices. Yeah, I saw that you actually cast some amazing other actors in this film to play Ethan Hawke, right?
Incredible.
So talk about what it was like, Jake, to carry the whole film through your face and a phone call and a voice, various voices on the other side of it.
Maybe serendipitously had just finished basically 6 months before a year run of a monologue, first off Broadway and then into Broadway. So, you know, an hour, some every night, you know, in front of an audience where you're telling a story and you can feel their imaginations click on. And then all of a sudden you're just the conduit of a story that's really going on in their own mind. And so I was used to that kind of process and had been in it live every night for a year. So coming to a movie which had a similar type of execution was, it didn't seem so foreign to me, you know? Though, you know, I also recognized that a lot of it had to do with the story being tense and following this, you know, this case, I guess, you know, it's a detective story in a lot of ways. It's a guy trying to figure out what's going on. And it's also about, as an audience, our misperceptions of people based on what we think they look like because of how they sound. You know, we never get to look at them or see them, and neither does he. So there was a lot of work being done for me in a lot of ways, you know. But it was a long journey, even though we shot it in 11 days. It was a, you know, 20 pages a day, shooting 20 to 30 minute takes, you know. And I thrive in that space, but I was also trapped in a chair. You know, Antoine sort of trapped me in a chair every time I wanted to move. I'm a very physical person. I'm a sort of full body actor. And then to only be in a chair, having to express, ended up doing a number on me as we got farther and farther into the story. I mean, stillness is one thing, but then being trapped is another thing. And it brought out a lot of feelings in me and I think revealed a lot of things about this character too.
When you say it got to you, how did that manifest itself?
I mean, look, so if you're sitting in my seat in a lot of ways, I mean, we all are in front of a computer, but let's say you're on a huge Zoom with a lot of people you can't see, and there are three cameras shooting you, and over the course of 11 days, the cameras that are shooting you start getting closer and closer and closer to your face. The technical qualities of, you know, we hadn't figured out how to act over Zoom, really. I mean, there are movies that were made during this time where people are actually on Zoom, but we all know that rhythm, right? We're used to it. We know that when we get on, we all say hi, but at different times, because we don't interrupt each other, because we can't actually overlap each other. And acting is all about rhythm and overlapping and when you do and when you don't and pauses. I mean, we actually have, you know, a pause is different than a beat, is different than a long pause, is different than a silence, you know, it's like, but when you have a technical piece of something defining your rhythm, you have to figure out how to act within it. So all the actors were on Zoom and, you know, the rhythm started to get set for us. And over a number of days, we had to figure out how to start our line even just earlier than the other one finished it, knowing that we were going to not hear the end of the line, but knowing that it would be recorded as if we were interrupting. So it was like you were like in a, I don't know, partial gravity room, you know, trying to keep your feet on the ground. That's the best way I can put
it. Wow. So the other actors are on Zoom.
They're on Zoom on a computer that I can see in my van. He can't see.
But he can't see them. He's just hearing them.
Yes.
Yeah, they're all in my ear.
Way to make a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of, I mean, well, also
right now I'm hearing a reverb just on what we're doing.
I'll shut up.
No. I'm just here. It's when Jake was talking, you could hear a little reverb, but he had reverb from his voice so he can hear his own voice, which is already nutty. Then he'd hear all the other actors' voices.
Yeah.
At the same, yeah. And he had me in his ear. So It's a little intense.
It's a lot.
Remember when Jake says being trapped, as he said, it made me really think about a lot of other things. Is when he said it started to get to him, is that the whole world is trapped. So normally in the movie, you can leave the set and you sort of freedom, you go out to dinner or go whatever, how you spend your life. In this case, you couldn't. You were constantly trapped. You're trapped because of COVID.
I mean, first of all, I'm still trying to get my head around an 11-day shoot. I mean, I can't believe that Antoine Fuqua, at this stage of your career, you're making any movie that takes 11 days, or Jake, you either. I mean, but let's just wind it back, because of course I have to ask you how you got to Jake for this character. You guys worked together on Southpaw, like amazing performance, one of the landmarks, Jake, I'd say in your career for sure, and in a career of lots of really, really interesting characters. So how did it either take this long to get back to him, or why was this project one that you wanted to bring to Jake?
It was actually the reverse. We've been trying to find something to do together since Southpaw. We've sent things back and forth. We've remained really good friends. And we just couldn't find the right one, or the timing wasn't right, or whatever it was. But we certainly were trying. And then out of the blue, really, Jake has been developing this for some time. I didn't know anything about it. And he called me one day and he said, I got this project. And he started to talk about it, and I could hear it in his voice how much he cared about it. And then he sent it to me to read. And I think the next day I texted him and said, I'm in. And then he said, okay, let's talk. And we talked, and it was like, that was it. But I don't know, why did it take you so long for you to get it to me, Jake?
You know what's really interesting about it is that, like, it had a real journey. I don't think I expected the movie to be made so quickly after we had gotten the rights. I don't think any of us anticipated what we were going to be going through in this sort of godforsaken past 2 years we've been going through. And I think, as always, things shift and change. I mean, we all know, particularly the three of us on this, in this interview, over doing your job for a number of years, you are expecting one thing and then it's not ever that thing. It's something else. And you grow accustomed to that. That is just the nature of the world, but it's also the nature of business in particular. And so I don't think I really knew that this would be the next one up, it just offered a space. And then I needed to figure out in my head what filmmaker would be down to get into the rougher spaces, but also new in those spaces, like loved the challenge, loved pushing limits, but also would always hold the line of quality and know how to handle me, frankly, in that space too, and know really how to shape this thing. And it was just like, there's nobody else to make the movie but Antoine. It was like, I knew that he would be down to get rough, I knew he would say, let's do it. And if I said five days, he'd say four. But then okay. I knew that if he came back to me and he said it had to be six, because I want to use these types of lenses and I want this crew and I want it to look like that, I'd be six, And then he'd say eight. No, wait, no, now three, I'd follow him wherever, because he was like quality control and also just someone who I knew wanted to get to something truthful.
So I want to talk a little bit about rage, which is something that suffuses the film from the very first frame that we see you, your character, Joe Baylor. Right off the bat, you're answering a 911 call and there is something not okay with you, Joe Baylor. Right away. And I have been thinking a lot about rage, male rage in particular. I think we're seeing explosions of toxic male rage everywhere in our society in ways that are very disturbing. And I don't really know myself how we're supposed to deal with this as a society. And I was curious how you were conceiving of that. It's not the first character, Jake, I've seen you play who's got something, that you're trying to deal with and not quite managing, right? Mm-hmm. What's your thought about that, about the rage in your character? And then if you have thoughts about sort of how this is becoming such an endemic experience across our society.
Well, I mean, my answer to your second question is, I think that there's a lot in this movie that talks about and undercurrents of that type of toxicity. And I think he's a profoundly morally complex character. I mean, I think he's a human being in a system that is broken. And he's a human being that doesn't know how to ask for help. And the system is not going to really help him, even if he did. And I think that the movie is a fantasy in a lot of ways, because the resolve of the film is not always real. But it is a fantasy for a reason, and I think it's a conversation starter. I mean, that was what Antoine and I always spoke about, was that it's about opening up a discussion about a lot of these ideas that you're talking about. And, you know, for me, I think it's so important to play deeply complex characters. I just don't think there's really any other way. I don't think I could do anything else. I have no desire to be portraying characters or human beings as one way or the other, or even human beings as just okay. You know, we are all so complicated. And I think it's so important that art and movies communicate characters as deeply complex, because hopefully, at least in my experience, you know, when we made Brokeback Mountain, you know, it was incredible to see that there was it offered the beginning of a healing process, of an understanding. And, you know, so much has changed since that time, but it opened a discussion that was full of love, a discussion that was full of discovery, a discussion that was full of rage, full of profound humor because of embarrassment people had about the ideas in it, you know, and because of all of those things, it moved things forward. So Antoine and I spoke a lot about this, and we continue to speak about it. And I think you're getting at some of the reasons why it meant so much for the two of us to make it together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Antoine, what are your thoughts? Yeah.
Well, it's a deep question. Is, you know, mental illness is real. Emotional illness is real. You know, when I was young, I asked my dad, I don't know, I was maybe 10, what does it mean to be a man when you talk about masculinity? And he took a long pause and thought about it. And he said, everything you got and then some. Right. So as a young man, you interpret it as being tough. Right. You can misinterpret those things sometimes, and he didn't mean that. But when you grow up, you don't know how to deal with your emotions as a young man. A lot of young men don't, because, you know, there's no markers for men to mm-hmm. tell you when you're mature, mm-hmm. right? We don't have that. If you play sports, at least you have some system you're in, and maybe talk to your coach. You have teammates to play off of. Once you turn a certain age, or if you're not involved with those sort of activities, who do you talk to when you feel a certain way? After 18, if you don't go to college, even if you do, you're kind of on your own, unless you're a part of some system, you know, sports or a group. If you're not, you're kind of on your own. And then at what point do you realize you're a grown up and mm-hmm. that you should maybe go seek help, self-help? Mm-hmm. At some point, that's okay. But that's one of the hardest things to do, is to seek self-help, right? And so you're afraid that you're going to discover something's wrong with you that you're afraid of, and it may limit you. And we witness that a lot in the military. When they get out of the military, a lot of guys take their lives. Policing, more police take their lives than they do. They die in the line of duty. There's something happening mentally and emotionally with young men, because how do you define what it means to be a man now? Like, what does it really mean? I think it needs to be redefined and talked about and explored. And in movies and art, we get a chance to make movies like The Guilty with Joel Baylor, who we get to witness his rage coming out, And we get to see what rage does, how it destroys, and how it can destroy, you know, other lives. And we get to see in the fantasy land some sense of resolve. But in the real world, that doesn't happen often enough. And I think people are afraid of mental illness. You know, when I was a kid, you say mentally ill, they made jokes about kids on a yellow bus. It was like a ugly thing, you know. That's not it at all, right? So that my feeling of rage is, starts with that. When you're talking about men, masculinity,
yes,
we have to redefine that. We have to talk about that openly. We have to have real discussions about it. We have to make films about it. I mean, look at Taxi. Taxi Driver was another movie about that.
That's right. Way back, right? 30 years. How many years back is that? But it feels like it's so much more widespread today. That guy was very much on the fringes of society.
Right.
Joe Baylor works for the police department.
Right.
I mean, it's so hard though to talk about the resolve of this without giving away the movie, you know, like, and you know, I think what's so important about the end of the movie is that truth has its consequences, but ultimately it frees you. Maybe not on this earth, but spiritually. And that's a very hard thing to understand or even face in a space where, you know, I don't think there's a safe space even at this point, really, for discussion. I don't think everybody feels safe to discuss all these issues. And I think the safest, most beautiful place right now is in art, I hope, begin with.
If I may, as the female in this conversation, who didn't make this movie at all, but who thinks about it and writes about it and works on these issues a lot, I think there's a lot of women out there who feel it's their time to speak. I think there's a lot of people of color who justifiably feel like it's their time to speak and time for white people to be quiet. And so men who are so used to having the floor don't feel so comfortable, you know, and also feel like, well, sure, maybe we had the floor for 400 years, but I was only born 20 years ago. So, you know, things like that. And so I actually really agree with you, Jake, and Antoine too. And I really appreciate this conversation so much that I don't think there is a space where we know where to talk about these issues yet. We really don't. And as parents who raise young men or as people going through society, it's so clear that we do need that discussion, it seems to me.
Yeah, I mean, desperately. And no one should be quiet right now. The floor belongs to all of us. No one, anyone gets to control anything because we're dying. The movie, Joe Baylor, when I spoke to Jake about it the first time you meet him, to me, internally is dying.
Hmm. I agree.
Which reflects the world we're in a bit, even our opening shot when you see the world's on fire. You know, it's urgent that we have the conversation. That's the whole point of that opening. It's urgent that we talk about it, or it's just burning down. And it's happening internally. We're burning down internally because we're not talking about the real issues. We keep dancing around it.
That made me think of something, Antoine, when you're saying that, which is that I do think that the old way is dying. And I think that if Joe Baylor is a representation of that idea, then I think that is the metaphor for this movie, that idea. And that's why, you know, we refer to it as a fantasy in a lot of ways, unfortunately, though it needs to become a reality. Mm-hmm. And I think like the first step is that expression.
But it's not just Joe. We made him, the goal was
to make the idea him. Of, the idea of is
but
what
the audience is challenged with who they are too, because we don't tell you anybody's color or who people are or what's right or what's wrong.
Right.
You experience it and you bring your own prejudice, your own thoughts to it. So when that happens, you have to step back and look at yourself to see, did you make a quick judgment about someone's voice or texture or tone or, you know, these things, something happens and you assume something. We have to step back a little bit. You know, everything's so fast now. Something happens, everyone jumps on their phone and has an opinion about it. Mm-hmm. And you have to step back and get some facts and get a little more information. So the audience, to me, is being challenged as well of what
Absolutely.
They think. So
Absolutely. Well, I don't want to take up your whole day. I know you guys have a lot of other interviews to do, but I really want to thank you. Thank you for coming to our studio and for, I mean, the film, I should say it's a thriller and it's really entertaining, but it's really getting at some deeper issues that we need to be talking about. And that's of course not surprising when it's coming from two really thoughtful principal movers in Antoine Fuqua and Jake Gyllenhaal. Thank you guys so much for coming to the Rap Studio and good luck with the film.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for this. Yeah.
Thanks for that question, really. It's important.
And now an interview with director Geeti Garr.
Last week I was reading the foreign section of the New York Times and learned there was a film that Prime Minister Naftali Bennett was using to urge greater unity within Israel. The film he was referring to, Legend of Destruction, has been an unexpected hit in Israel and is about the civil wars that raged among the Jews 2,000 years ago. Our next guest is the creator of that film, Geeti Garr. You may remember Garr as the filmmaker behind the acclaimed film Ushpizin from back in 2004 about the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community. He joins us today from his home in Atlit. Welcome, Geeti.
Hi, Sharon.
So nice to see you. I mean, it seems a very long time ago that you and I got to know each other. And then not surprised, but delighted to see that it was your film that the Prime Minister has been referring to in public statements. Just give us a little bit of background. What is the film about, and how has it been received by Israeli audiences?
So before saying what it's about, I'll tell you something about the form. The form is very, very unique. It's I think it's the only time it was ever done before. I mean, it's made with still paintings, the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an action movie. It's an action movie. It's a big historical drama, political thriller, whatever you want to call it, but it's big and epic and cinematic. You know, it's not like a museum piece, but it's made of steel. So that's, I think, the most important thing to know about
still photos, still paintings. Paintings. Yeah.
There was actually a movie, a very famous movie, made with steel photos, 20 minutes film, which was very abstract also, called La Jetée, by Chris Marker in the 60s. Mm. And it was a masterpiece. But this one is very different because it's much more, the storyline is almost Hollywood storyline. You know, it's not like,
tell our viewers a story, our listeners a story.
Okay, so the story is about, you know, it's 2,000 years ago. It's like 30 years after the crucifixion.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it's actually the same time exactly. And the Jews are under the Romans occupation, of course, Roman Empire. And they are divided to many, many groups, which doesn't get along very well. And there is big tension in the Jewish between the Jews, which burst in a second to a revolt against the Romans,
mm-hmm.
Which deteriorates into a civil war between each other, hunger, they destroy each other's food food supply, and by the time the Romans arrive, they're already like half destroyed, and the Romans just have to finish the work. And mm-hmm. it ends up with the destruction of the second temple, the second Jewish temple.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the most important moment, historical moment in Judaism, history, Jewish history.
Yeah.
And a very, very crucial moment in history of the world. You know, it's a big, big, big change in the, which, you know, for the Jews and for the world.
Mm, in fact, many people who've been to Rome have seen the Arch of Titus that has the images of the Roman army carting off the treasures of the Jewish temple. As a Jewish person, you know, I was taught about this history growing up, but I've never seen it render dramatically in that way. But quick, give me like just a sense of like how...
Let me add you something. The Colosseum. Yeah. The Colosseum mm-hmm. in Rome was built...
The Colosseum, yes.
The Colosseum, sorry. With the money looted from the temple.
I was always taught, in fact, when I've done a book about antiquities, which I think you know, which is called Loot. In fact, there's a thing, there's a a book cover on my wall. When I went to Rome to research antiquities, I learned at that time from a BBC historian, which I did not know, that the gold that was used to gild the Colosseum actually came from the Jewish temple, which as like a sign of screw you by Titus to a stiff-necked colonial.
Money has no smell.
All right, so let's just talk about, okay, this is an unlikely film to hit a nerve. How is it done in Israeli theaters?
What do you mean, how is it done? Was it released?
I mean, how is it performed? Are people going to,
it performed great. Later on, the problem is after a few weeks, the corona arrived back to Israel and, it's not an easy ride. We're still on right now, but it was the public reaction was crazy. It was crazy. It seems like this subject, it was just under the rug for the whole time of the existence of this country, just waiting to be uncovered.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, there is in the Jewish history. There is a Jewish gene, you know, that is of self-destruction. And it's there. It happened before. It happened twice before in the history of the Jews that we destroyed ourselves after 70 years of existence.
Mm-hmm.
And like we flourished, we fought to build it. We flourished. We were amazing. We did unbelievable stuff. Mm-hmm. And then in 2-3 years, we just destroyed the whole thing. And normally it was something, it always started with something which is internal by the Jews. It was never just the external enemy. The external enemy was just a pawn in this whole game, which is an internal game of the Jews playing with themselves.
So obviously it seems as if you're drawing a parallel to today.
You know, when I started this project, it took a long time, this project. It took 8 years. I just hopped in with no money. I just started working, and so I got all the money as I was going.
Mm-hmm.
What
was the impetus? What was the point of departure for the decision to take on a project like this?
So I just read this book. It was 2013. I read a book about Josephus Flavius, the historian, the Jewish historian,
mm-hmm.
which was present at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the deal, you know, part of the whatever happened over there,
mm-hmm.
and he ended up to be a traitor. But he wrote, he was adopted by Caesar, by the Roman Caesars,
mm-hmm.
who destroyed Jerusalem, Titus, and his father Vespasian, who built the Colosseum,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote for them the history of what happened over there.
Mm-hmm.
In his very, very famous book, which is called The War of the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And I just read a book about him. And, you know, in Israel, beside the religious people, the secular people don't know a lot about this story. They heard something about mm-hmm. senseless hatred, but they don't understand what really happened over there. And at the same time, it was 2013, in Syria, hell broke loose completely. Okay, what we call the Arab winter, as opposed to the Arab
right.
spring.
You're talking about the civil war in Syria, the rebels against the Assad regime.
Yes, mm-hmm. and everybody against everybody, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And like utter destruction, just 50 kilometers
horrible.
Away.
Horrible, horrible, horrible.
And I was reading this stuff at the same time and said, man, it's the same stuff.
Mm.
It's exactly the same materials, even worse, what we did to ourselves. So, and it was a shock to me to discover how little I know about this story as an Israeli,
mm-hmm.
as a Jew, mm-hmm. a secular Jew, and how similar it is to what's going on. So if you're talking about referring to the Israeli reality at this time, at the beginning, it wasn't like that. But as I was moving forward, it became more and more similar because what happened to me also was that I started with Josephus Flavius, the historian, But then I gifted.
I'm going to say it with the English. We call him Josephus, just so people who are trying to figure out what we're talking about and want to look him up. I did a lot of Googling after I saw your movie, learned about a lot of historical, very interesting characters I didn't know existed. But anyway, continue. Yeah, we call him Josephus in English.
Please correct me. I'm going to have to speak a lot of English.
No, no, it's all, I mean, these are, you know, Vespasian. They're all pretty close. I don't speak Latin or Greek. Continue.
The way it's spoken is said in English. And so I drifted to, as I started with Josephus,
mm-hmm.
and I drifted to the Talmud, because the Talmud has legends, has a big corpus of legends, which are amazing, which I really like. If the Greeks has the Iliada, we have the Talmudic legends.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And again, these secular Israelis don't know at all. It's unbelievable they don't know that, but it's some kind of alienation from your own past,
mm-hmm.
you know, from your own sources. And those legends are amazing. And half of those legends are called legends of destruction.
In the Talmud, they're called that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they speak about the destruction of the temple of the first and the second. And some of them you don't know which one we're referring to. And what they say in the Talmud through those legends, and then they don't care so much about the facts. It's not a problem.
So I wanna tell our listeners a little bit why it is such an arresting film. So as Gidi was saying earlier, there are about 1,500 paintings that make up the entire imagery of the film. Which is they're absolutely gorgeous and very evocative paintings. It doesn't look like an animated film. It looks like something different. It doesn't look like a live film either. But it does really create an incredible amount of emotion and impact through, I guess, the way you use the camera across the paintings, and through the actors who are very, very evocative and very effective. And the music, the score, which is just really punctuates the story points, you know, it actually brings to mind in some ways I think it makes me think of Game of Thrones or something like that, because you're back in the Iron Age or something. But you know, there's a lot of violence, quite a lot of violence, even though these are still. These are paintings, but you still feel the impact of the violence that's going on, both between the warring Jewish sects and then, of course, this massive Roman army that lands on the shores of Palestine, or whatever it was called at that time. Was it called Israel?
Palestine and Judea.
To put down this rebellion and make this vassal state come to heel. And there's a queen, who was Queen Berenice, is not somebody I was familiar with at all. So let's come back and talk a bit about, because this, I think, that was so, part of what's so unexpected about this film and unique is the response that you've gotten in Israel. So you were starting to say that Israelis have had a huge reaction and it was like something just below the surface. But can you talk a little more about what you mean by that?
Okay, so Israel today is very fractured.
Mm.
Okay. And there, you know, there is a secular Ashkenazi and there are the ultra Orthodox and the right wing religious and the Arabs, and there are many other groups, and they all have problems with each other, which democracies have. But the discourse is becoming more and more and more violent,
mm-hmm.
and is in the risk of losing control. And actually, in the last war, or how we call it, operation in Gaza this year.
In Gaza, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they fired rockets at us. And that was a problem, of course. But we're kind of used to that, and we retaliate, and you know, the whole game goes again.
Mm-hmm.
And but what was a big trouble? What was really what feared the Israelis was not what the rockets in the sky. It was what happened in the streets of Israel.
Right.
That there was violence in the streets between Arab and Jews, between the mobs.
Right.
And that felt like something, and it was a week like that, that you couldn't hold it up, couldn't control it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a feeling that if it just goes one more step or two more steps ahead, that's it. We're losing control. And you could suddenly see, and people were urging me, just release the film already. And we couldn't release it yet. There were no cinemas. But it was like the real thing. You were watching and understanding this can happen really, really quickly, exactly like in the movie.
Well, another pressure thing, of course, Israel is in a pressure cooker region, and the country in many ways is a pressure cooker. You add to that missiles landing or not, or nearly landing on people. And then you add to that the pressure cooker of COVID for the past year and a half.
Absolutely.
And you really have a recipe for people acting out.
And you have to add one more thing.
Mm.
And that's a big distrust with the government. Of big part of the audience, mm-hmm. of the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's, you know, and that's also something that in the Talmud they're talking about.
They're about talking not trusting not trusting the government.
About corruption.
Corruption.
And its relation to distrust and the loss of control.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a big problem, I mean, in Israel, whether you believe him or you don't believe him, you're in one. You have to choose a side with Bibi Netanyahu,
mm-hmm. the previous prime minister, right?
Yeah, the previous prime minister mm-hmm. of Israel, which was accused in major corruption,
mm-hmm.
and this create. And we are after four rounds of election over here.
Yeah,
which really four in 2 years. Was crazy. It got crazy. It got like, and the leash, was unleashed. You know, it was, you know, in the TV, in you know the campaign, they got crazy over here.
Right, and Netanyahu did the same thing that Trump did. Right, he accused the process, the electoral process, of not being, not of course to the extent that Trump did, who took it, who still
no. I don't think he did that. Actually, I don't think he did that.
No.
We did a lot of other stuff, you know, but what you understand is that when someone, and I'm not saying, you know, was corrupt, okay, I'm not a judge, I don't know, okay, there are serious accusations, it has to be checked, I don't know, but when he was accused of being corrupt, his answer was not, I'm innocent, it was, you're a leftist, that's why mm-hmm. you're saying this, because you want me out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he has an interest of dividing us all of a sudden. You know, not all of a sudden, we're divided all the time. And dividing, that will end, can end up in serious violence and loss of control. And, you know, when some American distributors saw this film, one or two, and, you know, and they liked it very much. And what they said was, look, it reminds us of what's going on over here.
It does.
Which is not something, it's something that has a problem. I mean, all democracies in the West has this problem today. If you add to all the items you said, if you add for the internet.
Yeah, for sure.
And Instagram and all that, you know, all those social medias, which, you know, this is a very frightening recipe.
Do you think that the movie will get distribution in the United States?
I believe it will.
You think so? Okay, on a streamer or in theaters?
Look, the only problem I have, I'm sure it has to go for theaters because it's, you know, this movie.
You want people to see it on a big screen.
It's a very serious experience. It's a very big experience in theater. You know, it will be theatrical. You know, the sound and the image is like the big screen. It's something which is, you saw the level of the quality of the paintings. It's, And the sound.
So you would like to find a theatrical release in the United States. Well, I really hope that deal happens. And I, you know, I think that there's a lot of independent films that are doing pretty well right now because there's not so much competition for space in the theaters. But I really hope that the message that you're sending, which is a kind of a warning to all of us in every democracy about what happens when we lose proportionality and we lose sight of our common values and let our lower impulses and our desire for power.
You know, I've said something. It's not just, it can be the lower impulses, but there's also one very serious basic impulse that we all have, and that's being right. And everybody in this movie are right. Cool. They're all right.
To be right.
And together they all dance to hell. Because they're all so right. It's so right, you know, and nobody's right. willing to compromise into dialogue. And there are many crossroads in the movie where they could stop it. It's about a city going mad, losing control. And there are crossroads that they could have stopped it over there. And they don't. Because they think it's going to be okay. And they don't understand how quickly that this can lose control.
You lose control, and how similar human nature is, and how some basic parts of the dynamic of human relations just doesn't change. You know, that we don't learn enough from history. But anyway, Gidi, thank you so much for giving us this incredibly powerful view of the past and the lessons that we need to learn from that. And I really do hope that we get to see the film on screens here in the United States. Gidi, thank you so much for joining the wrap-up.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Aaron.
And that's it for this week's episode of The Wrap-Up. Thank you to all of our listeners, and remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. See you next time. Thank you.